And tonight, we are fortunate to have an old friend of the group to come down and speak tonight. So will y'all give me a help us give me a warm welcome to Stephanie from Midtown.
Thanks, Billy. I'm Stephanie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Stephanie.
Before I get started, I just want to thank my dear friend Billy for asking me to come out and be of service to you guys here tonight. I really value the opportunity to carry the message because I know it's something that I have to do, both to hopefully deposit some hope to somebody that might need it, and also because it's the medicine for me to stay sober, which matters to me quite a bit because I definitely am convinced to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. So thank you for this opportunity, and it's so good to see you. So, and thanks, Joyce, for coming with me, my best friend in the world. And I'll talk about how we got that way, and it's definitely through a lot of conversations about God, and continues to be, for us, the common denominator in everything we do and every struggle we have together. We always end up back on no human power and trying to turn it over and asking God for help. So I always start with, I first got drunk when I was 9, and it just helps me get started. And I also think that that is probably unusual. I would imagine that most 9-year-olds don't get wasted. Now, I definitely didn't start drinking at 9. And I don't remember a lot about it, but the reason I mention it is, well, first for that reason. And also, you know, we don't know. I'm so grateful that the literature talks about a lot of different times. It'll say, like, you know, we don't know. We don't have the answer. There's a lot of puzzles. There's a lot of riddles. There's a lot of paradoxes. And so I don't know if I was, like, born this way. Did I drink my way into it? Was there a certain experience or season of my childhood or teen years? I have no idea. I just know that at 9 years old, the disgusting taste of bourbon was not enough to stop me from drinking it until I got drunk. So then I really started drinking. And I can tell you, like, as a child, just because it's worth checking in on, you know, even then. So 10 years old would be my first time having my stomach pumped at the hospital because I faked a suicide because I wanted my parents' attention, you know, and I did a very dramatic job with that. I took my mom's tranquilizers that she had to deal with me. And on the side of the bottle, it said not to mix them with alcohol because you would become very drowsy. So I took some of them. I sprinkled some of them around me, and I drank a bunch of orange liqueur, and I just laid on the bathroom floor and waited to fall asleep. And it did scare the bejesus out of my parents, and they rushed me to the hospital. And so that was the first time that I would kind of go to that type of length. And what was the real reason for that? I was so distraught because my parents wouldn't let me go somewhere where my friends were hanging out, watching a movie. Like, I don't know. For some reason, I wasn't allowed to go. And I remember even then, like at 10 years old, that was the beginning of the very thought, like just such insecurity, such an inability, lack of power. I mean, the thought of my friends advancing in their friendship without me was like a death sentence to me, and I would behave that way. And I started creating confusion with everyone that loved me in the way I would react to that fear of being left out or not being included, or just whatever you call it. I would behave in strangely insane. And that got me, you know, I ransacked my own room. I got sent to my room, and what do? Destroy it. And our literature talks about that, beating your head with the mallet of anger intended for someone else, you know? And I remember what that was like. I was like, I want new fashion plates, which was like this. Do you remember those? You would like etch over them and you could make outfits. Definitely a no. You do? Huh. But I smashed all my fashion plates with a hammer, and then I wanted new ones. And my dad was like, no, like you have to suffer the consequences of what you did. And so this is just what I brought to my drinking eventually when I really started drinking, which was the summer before 9th grade. That was kind of like the commencement into my partying lifestyle. And what I remember about that is, you know, being carried out of the woods. That would be common for me, not always being carried out of the woods per se, but just overshooting the mark and kind of coming to with people around me. That I have visions of that over the period of my drinking, you know, from the beginning up until some of my last drinks, is coming out of some kind of blackout or pass out and people concerned and staring down at me. So that's just, you know, and it wasn't always like that. Lynn and I were just talking. I mean, I had so much fun drinking. That's the truth. And, you know, my early years of drinking and, you know, through high school and even my early 20s, I associated with music festivals and concerts and road trips. And I mean, I did love to drink and drive, to be honest. I loved to be drunk on a nice day with the windows down and listening to my favorite music and smoking Marlboro Lights and just like free as a bird, you know. And then I got my first DWI. Put a little crimp in that kind of, I was like, okay, this is illegal. And then I got another DWI, and then I got a third DWI. And I just mean, I've always liked to be in my car listening to music. So it makes sense that I was a big drinker and driver. But this is what I associate the early years of drinking to, is so much fun. In fact, if I met you in those days and you didn't drink, I would feel sad for you. Really sad. Like, I remember a couple people that didn't drink, and of course the judgmental part of me would have that feeling like loser, but also I would be like compassionate, like, that is so sad, like, how come no one ever showed you like how to party? Like, I really wouldn't understand how what happened, like what sort of sad fate got you in this like jackpot. And so it was fun. And then I think, like, in the what happened, I mean, that kind of angst that I described in the beginning of what I was like as a child, and that sort of Jekyll and Hyde that our book talks about, was always with me, you know. And it was described to me many different ways over the years. My dad used to always be like, you just got to learn to count to 10, because I had a notoriously horrible temper, no pause. That was always like my worst defect, far and away. Like, anybody that knew me would tell you that right away. Like, they would preface, probably, she's sweet, but she's got a temper. And so I was marked by that from the earliest years. And so what sort of the combination of beginning to drink and party, like I described, and loving a lot of it, and then the beginning episodes of the incomprehensibly demoralizing things that started to happen as I got older, you know, it just kind of started to mount on itself. So drinking was becoming less fun and the humiliation was getting heavier. And then before I knew it, honestly, I mean, it's just kind of, it happens gradually. But I was drinking to preserve my sanity and my peace of mind. And I didn't know, it happened so fast. I mean, that noticing it happened fast. I had been drinking, doing shots. I bartended for years. Let's see. Okay, I can slow down. I bartended for years in college and a little bit after college, and I could drink a lot. I could always drink more than most people. I could always do like a double shot of bourbon or something that would kind of set people off. Like, that was uncommon. But I never really associated it with being able to instantly, you know, change my perception of how I viewed the world. Now, it had been doing that for me for years. I just associated it with fun and freedom. And in many ways, I was thinking of it that way, but I just didn't realize the type of medicine it was for me, the type of power it had. Until at about 27, I had this bartending job. And, you know, before this point and leading up to this, I had already, after high school, I'll try to go from high school to this 27-year-old Stephanie without getting lost, see if I can do it. I graduated high school, and a lot of my close comrades and people that I grew up with were going to college, and I had not facilitated that at all for myself. My parents were immigrants. They didn't go to college, and they just didn't push that. You know, I mean, I remember my dad actually saying, like, I don't think you might not be cut out for college. And he really wanted me to get a job on Capitol Hill, because that's what he always did. And he was like, you can start like working in the parking lot as a parking lot attendant. I was like, that sounds awesome. Work your way up, you know, because he had that pride being an American citizen. He was such a hard worker, and he worked his way up, you know, being on the Senate staff. And so he really wanted me to follow in his footsteps, but it was not going to happen. And so when I graduated high school, I went off to Colorado, and I was very grateful that this plan emerged, because at first, the first feeling I had was like this profound, deep, like direct hit. Like everyone was going off to college. I didn't have a plan. And again, that feeling of being left out, like not good enough. I mean, I was plagued with worry almost since I was a little kid. In fact, my dad used to tell me, like, it was just weird. You were always concerned about being homeless. And I was like, that's really depressing, you know, but I had that, like, whatever. We don't know. I don't know. Had that, those worries. And so I went off to Colorado, right, like about a year after high school, actually, with this guy that I had been worshipped all through my teen years. He went to a different high school. And when I was living in Colorado in Steamboat Springs, even though that feeling of malcontentedness and a lot of times despair and depression and, you know, definitely humiliating myself in bars and all of the wild stuff that I would do, despite the fact that I also, like I was saying, would have so much fun. I mean, I saw Neil Young at Red Rocks twice. I saw Soundgarden at Red Rocks. I mean, I would go to Red Rocks Amphitheater all the time and see the best music. And I would love that part of it, because that's where I would be the perfect buzz. And sometimes drugs were part of that scenario to just kind of enhance things. But there would always be, I can't even remember, and this is just a snapshot of my best drinking nights, you know, there was always a part of the night, whether it was in the morning or in the evening, trying to fall asleep, wherever I was, where I would have just this feeling of complete and utter despair. I always had that on the front end, back end, but somewhere in there, I would feel that. And, you know, when you start talking about it and being vocal about it, people just, rightfully so, they want you to get a therapist. And maybe that's what's needed. I don't know. I tried a lot of that stuff, but it never really seemed to help me. And I remember one psychiatrist told me I had rejection sensitivity disorder. And he prescribed me like a cocktail of things. And that was in my mid-20s. And I remember the medicine made me very, it made me gain like 15 pounds like that. It happened so fast. I thought the dryer was shrinking my clothes. So it was just stuff like that. But when I was in Colorado those few years, you know, the best part about it was when I came home and saw my friends from childhood, I had cooler stories than them. You know, I could squash their keg story parties with my snowboarding and Steamboat, check out my ski pass. And that meant something to me. Like I felt I was on a way more exciting, adventurous journey than they were. And for whatever reason, these are the things that just drove me. But none of it was obviously sustainable or real. And, you know, I had those three DWIs I mentioned. Eventually I just got in so many scrapes. I had this boyfriend and we would get in fights and we eventually broke up and I got into a car accident. My dad said he would bail me out if I came back to Maryland and went to college. So I did. Came back here and I got myself enrolled in Montgomery College. I did well. And then I got into University of Maryland. In this period of my life, I built up a lot of hope for my family because it looked like I was going to pull out a win against all odds. So I graduated from college, and then to make it worse, I graduated with honors. So they were like, she's going to be something. And I was like, no. The very idea of it disturbed me so greatly. And I knew it was coming. I mean, it was like walking the guillotine to me as people started to get excited. Like, it's the tech boom. There's so many great jobs. And I was just like, kill me. Because I didn't want to grow up. I mean, I did not want the party to stop. And that's like, you know, when I look back at some of the fears that drove me, I mean, even up until my last drink, which I'll get to, which was at 40 years old, because I got sober and I drank again, wanting to be like in that eight, you know, 21-year-old, 25-year-old at the mute, that the show, that I loved that image of myself, the, you know, like the girl that needed help and like the just this movie, you know, none of it real. The bottles were my friends. I mean, I created this imaginary world of grandiosity and true love and romance. And I don't know. I mean, did I love movies too much? I mean, I really don't know what created this type of insanity, but I really lived in it deep, deep in it. And when I graduated, I did get a real job, as we like to call it. And which really meant I wasn't bartending anymore. And I remember my parents taking a picture of me that first day at this job. They were like, let us get a picture of you, like you would do for your kids first day at school, in my like skirt and like button down shirt. And I was just like, ugh. And, but as a matter of fact, I called in sick my first day at work. So this was the second day. And I said I had food poisoning. But so I entered this world and the misery really came down hard on me, you know, just having to, now it just felt like, I don't even know how to describe it. Honestly, it was just, I felt like such a phony. I also hated it. So not a phony because I didn't want to be there, but I had to fake like I did and just listening to people talk. I mean, I can remember so clearly how painful it was to talk to work people, you know, and the things that they would say about their lives and what meant something to them was like, it was just poison to my ears. I mean, I just would feign. I mean, I have had people be like, are you falling asleep? And I'm like, no, what? Because it is so painfully boring to me. And I could see that people were excited. They were like, I just made my first investment. And then they'd be like pumped. And I was just like, I want to go to see this band at this bar. And I have this boyfriend who has a skateboard at 30 and I love him. And I don't want to hear anything about this. And you know, all of that. So it was just really hard. But the other thing is, like a lot of us, if not all of us, I had a lot of potential. So I was a very strong starter. I mean, I would just come out the gate on fire and everyone would be like, oh my God, Rainmaker. And then all of a sudden, I'd have no interest in any of it and confuse everyone. And so this producing confusion was something I did everywhere I went, you know. We had this man that we loved, Frank, who used to say that alcoholics are pristine at snatching defeat out of the jaws of victory. And that's what I would do. I just always would inevitably, no matter how good things were, I couldn't see it. And I would eventually feel that my head was on fire and I was going to die or whatever it was, based in not getting the right kind of attention, approval, you know. It's just such an injustice, always with that. And the drinking saved me from that feeling. And I just didn't know that, you know, until 27, got back there. So I'm 27, I get fired from this bartending job. Oh, wait, now I went back in time. Okay, that's all right. So I got fired from this bartending job, which was right before I started that real job that I just was talking about. And those people that fired me, it was an intervention and I didn't notice that at all. You know, it just went right over my head. And I remember Nancy, the owner of the nightclub, it was her and Louie that owned this place. And she was crying, you know, just like my dad would do. And just like my mom would do, because it was really hard for her to have to kind of kick me out of her life because I was behaving like a maniac, because I was a strong starter and she developed a real deep affection for me. And now she was having to fire me and it was heartbreaking for her. And I reacted to it just exactly like you would be afraid I would. And I just went out like a hot mess and drama, let them believe I was going to go commit suicide. I put that, you know, on them. And that's just the type of way I would behave, you know, just leave people wondering if I would emerge alive. And that kind of worry, you know, just and then just like the book talks about, when I was feeling better, Anna Grand, the wind stopped blowing, you know, like, hey, I'm over it. You should be, too. I'm the one that struggles, you know. And so this would go on and everywhere, you know, and as I'm getting older, so now let's fast forward to graduating college, working at this job. And this is really what the long beginning of what happened, which is that I couldn't live this double life anymore. And so one day I just quit this job, nowhere to go, no other job. I just stood up and said, here's my notice. Made up a lie about where I was going because it was just such a weird thing to do. People just didn't do that. You know, you just quit for no reason. It's very irresponsible, reckless, and foolish, which is exactly what I was. And I went back to the beach and to bartend. And I remember my dad crying, you know, because he knew I was going backwards. I remember how disappointing that was for him. I was 30 years old, quitting this good job that I worked, you know, just he watched me work so hard and to get through college. And now I'm just going back to what I was doing before. And it really disturbed him, but I did it. But really what I was doing actually is I was this kind of grandiose. I wanted to get my boyfriend back that I had, who lived in this trailer in Bethany Beach, the skateboarder. And he wouldn't have anything to do with me. We'd had another just abusive, terrible, violent relationship. But I figured if I lived in his town and he saw me regularly, he would fall back in love with me, because how could he not, you know? And so that was my plan. And it was a horrible disaster. And that was kind of the aggressive drain circling. I got there. I moved into this townhouse. I had this girl that moved out quickly, or she didn't move out, but she wouldn't come back because she was so scared of me. And the things I was saying in my drunken blackouts, I was constantly threatening suicide. That was like my main battle cry. And somebody called my mom, you know, that knew my mom, and my mom came and got me. They had tried a couple times to visit with me while I was there, and I would kick them out. And she came and got me and brought me home, and they had another intervention, this time with the family. Or they didn't have, this was their first intervention. It would be my second sitting. And but I didn't realize the first one was an intervention. This one, it was really obvious. And the pastor of the church was there, and my mom's best friend, and my mom and dad, and they sat me down, and somebody had obviously coached them on how to do this. And they were, you know, telling me that they wanted me to go to AA, and my drinking was a big problem and all of this stuff. And I just put on this huge show for them that there's no good time to take a sip of water. I'm just going to do it. And I put on this big show, especially I made mainly focused on my dad, and that this was the wake up call I needed. And I know it's been a lot of years of me and my nightmares, but now that I was going to never drink again, that's what I told them. And I went to try to go to bed, and it was what I believe the only compulsion I've ever had of that magnitude that I can recall in my entire life, which was I was going to drink if I had to crawl to the booze. Luckily, I didn't have to go far. It was hidden in the shed in the backyard. So I drank, got drunk there. And my mom woke me up in the morning and in the shed. And the look on her face was pure disgust. So I was caught in my soul. I felt I needed her. I mean, without them, I'm in the women's shelter. So that was very scary. I mean, not literally. I probably could have couch surfed with some folks, or I had a few good years left in my mind to run, come up with some kind of plan, but I was caught. So I didn't realize this at the time. Looking back, I sometimes think, and who knows if this is true or it's all filtered through my mind. So, but I sometimes think my drinking was interrupted in some ways, you know, because I would drink again, but first I would go to AA that night, and I would meet my now home group and a lot of incredible members of AA, and I would try to get sober, and I did eventually get sober. And that was in 2003. And, you know, I met Billy probably that same year, first time, and Lynn. And I was scooped up, you know, scooped up by these people that were doing the steps out of the book, you know, and I was taken through the steps, and I was definitely one of the, you know, the more outwardly defiant. I think we're all equal defiant. Like, that's one of the chief characteristics of all of us. Some of us are more flagrant about it than others. And I definitely erred on the side of loud and sometimes like aggressive. And so, but I did eventually get really sober. And I'll tell you, it meant a lot to me to get sober. I mean, it's my credits don't transfer. I drank again, but I can remember in those first few years that the work that went into that. I mean, the level of honesty that I had to exhibit to get that honest sobriety date. Which actually wasn't till 2004, because what I like to do when I'm cornered is find some way that you won't know I'm not sober, like narcotics or anything. Just so I did that. And then in 2004, I got a real sobriety. I got honest about everything. And I mean, I think it's page 125, somewhere around there in here. It talks about if you ask an alcoholic why they drank again, they might have many, you know, reasons they'll give you, which I could list off reasons. I mean, my dad died. The guy I was going to marry pulled the plug out from under me, and then he left AA, wasn't an alcoholic. I mean, my world got turned upside down. Many people stayed sober. I know many people that have stayed sober through much harder terms than that. You know, I just leaned out. But I think looking back, one of the more important things that even happened before that was that, and I know how important this is now, is that I had these lurking notions that I wouldn't talk about. I had these, I mean, I never believed I'd be in AA one day at a time forever, nor did I want to, but I wouldn't tell anyone that. To me, it was just temporary to get certain hallmark life achievements handled soberly. Once I got that all squared away, I just figured either my alcoholism would be solved or cured, or I just thought I'd be able to drink safely eventually after enough time in AA. And where I got sober, I was, had lots of friends and, you know, boyfriend, like I said, and was going to get married. And I was kind of part of this world that was pretty cool. I mean, it could have been better if we were partying, I thought, safely, but you know, if this is how we're doing it here, fine. So I had this very skewed way of really looking at things, and I never really fully got honest about that. And I think that was probably the biggest mistake I made, but it doesn't matter. I drank again after that succession of bad news happened. And in that short period of time, which was from 2008 until 2010, I returned to drinking. I tried to get sober again a few times. One time my drinking was interrupted and I just was like, came to an emergency room with AA people around, circled up around me because they knew me. So I had these friends from, I mean, Joyce. I sat with Joyce on her porch a couple times during the drinking and us, you know. So, but I could never do it and was never really willing, didn't want to. Didn't get sober. And then one day, and the way I was living in that blip of hell is I was living with my mom, who had lost her husband to 50 years pretty recently. She's got her daughter who's, I don't know, like 39 or something like that, who's can't work, just gets drunk all the time alone at home. Also can stop drinking for a couple of days if she has enough pills, which I'm not going to go into any big detail about that, but sometimes I can control my drinking if I had the right amount of opiates. And so just putting my mom through hell, that was like, mainly what I was doing. And then every once in a while I'd go visit people from AA, you know, and just for some camaraderie, I guess. I couldn't go anywhere. I didn't want to do anything. I was completely reclusive. I remember there were some people that there's like a, you know, little clan of people that had left AA. There's like the people that left AA group, you know, trying to make it together. And they would try and get me to come out with them. And I had no interest in that and nothing. I just didn't, it was awful. My life was, I was completely and utterly out of hope. You know, I wasn't really going around drinking and driving. I was just alone by myself, getting drunk, looking at myself in the mirror, trying to imagine some footage in my mind of hope or something, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't pray. I would try and I couldn't pray. And then one day one time I tried to get sober and I stayed for a little while and I was put in the psych ward, by the way. I forgot to mention, healthy nod to the nut house that I was in, or the asylum. And that happened. Somebody from AA, I needed a ride home. So I pretended like I was going to get sober so they would pick me up. And then I just went right back. And so, you know, I had done a lot of damage. I got into an ultra. Oh, this is what I was trying to say about my poor mom is that, so she's got me there living with her, just creating so much worry and pain. And then sometimes my brother would come and we would violently fight, and he was 43. So she's got her kids, her wonderful children, that are acting like 12-year-olds, except they're grown ups. So it's terrifying. And she's having to deal with that. And then one time my brother came with his wife and daughter, and you know, I wasn't in AA anymore. I had no principles that I was living on. I hadn't literally, I was had just made a beginning at getting a pause before I got sick again and returned to drinking. So now I had no pause again. A resentment that I'd been trying to push down with my sister-in-law. So I just literally threatened to kill her. Her brother beat me up. And I destroyed those relationships in one evening, you know, in front of my 10-year-old niece. So that was very bad. And then a few days later, I was just laying there. And I had told myself a lot of stories about AA and the people in it to try to justify how I was living and what I was doing. You know, the easy number one was always that AA is a cult. I mean, the obvious go-to. So I would do that. And, you know, just that, I would just kind of make fun of it in my mind. It's just a weak, like, terrible place, you know. And I had convinced myself that it made my life worse, not better, you know, the standard victim stuff. But so when people would say every once in a while, why don't you go to a meeting? It literally was, it didn't, in my mind, translate as even an option. Like, it was just another person telling me something stupid that had nothing to do with what was wrong with me. That's how I felt. But on this one night, my friend Jack called me and he was like, why don't you come to a meeting tonight? And I was like, no, thank you. But, you know, I was so touched that people would call, but no, thank you. And he was like, all right. And then he called me right back and he said, Johnny's here and he would love to see you. And that's Johnny H. I don't know if any of you know him. I'm not trying to name drop, but this is just part of the real story. So I said, well, all right, then, you know, like it got to my, he was smart. He got to my ego. I thought, I'm one of Johnny's beloved favorites. I should go and see him type of thinking, I guess. I don't know what I was thinking, but it worked. And I went, and then I went to the meeting. And this is, like I said, in 2010. And I was not planning on getting sober. I don't know what, I was just insane. Who knows what I was planning. I had no plans. I was in hell. But I got to this meeting and Johnny, I remember him. I remember the doors opening and it was like everything was in slow motion. And it felt like this is how sick and riddled my mind was with negativity, paranoia, resentment. It felt like everyone turned because it made noise when I opened the door. Of course, I got there a little late and everyone turned to look. And I just felt like they all were thinking this loser is, you know. Or they were looking at me with hatred or disdain, or because the grandiosity and the drama you tell yourself, like you've really devastated AA as a whole by leaving, you know, like you think you really like left this, you know, like horrible scar that no one healed from. So it's so ridiculous. So that's what I thought I was like walking into. But after Johnny got done talking, he came over to me and I will never forget what he said. He said, Stephanie, we don't have to bury you over this thing. And for some reason, it was one of the first times that somebody saying something like that to me didn't seem like I didn't have an irreverence or a sardonic mind about it, which normally what it looked like is, oh my God, you guys are so dramatic, like jails, institutions, or death. There's obviously thousands of other ways this could go. You know, I always had that that defiance and that argument, so always opinionated and everything. But when he said that, I just knew something about it. I just knew it was right. I just knew there was like a surrender right then and there of some sort. And then I remember he was in town for a few days and I went to a meeting a couple of days later and I was able to get a little bit honest with him about the truth about me, which is that what am I really afraid of? I'm afraid that you don't like me that much, that I'm not pretty enough and I'm not cool enough and I'm going to be alone and all the exact same fears that every single one of us have. But to say it out loud, that is too much of weak sauce for me to eat. I'd rather die. So I started to be able to use that language to the very people that I used to be most afraid of knowing it, you know what I mean? And that was a big sort of a seismic pivot for me. Mm-hmm. was to be able to start doing that, you know. And I said to him, I'm so afraid that these people hate me. This brain, he said, Stephanie, you know, he goes, there is people that are just never going to like you. And there's just not going to be anything you can do about it. And there's going to be people that will always love you. And there's just not going to be anything you can do about it. And that got my attention. I remember I wrote it down and, you know, I just love him so much, so much. But anyway, so that was the beginning. Now I would go a few months. I got my sponsor and who I'd had before as a sponsor, and I loved her so much. And she immediately was like, yes, I'll sponsor you. I'm speaking. So I went to that meeting and then I decided I was going to get sober. I'm like, all right, I'll do this. And I called her, will you sponsor me? Yes, but I'm speaking at the Memphis City Roundup. Can you meet me there? And I was like, in Memphis? And she was like, yes. And I was like, you know, this is, and then so that thinking starts up. I'm like, this is what I mean. This is so, you know, what was the word I would use? Like fanatical. Like I'm not coming to Memphis. I lived in Maryland, but I exhibited the willingness. And I tell you what, I don't know if I could do that today. But I was that desperate. I look back and know, because I got on a plane and I went to Memphis by myself, got there, and I was in rough shape. As a matter of fact, there was like 1,500 people at this conference. It was huge. The Memphis City Roundup. Maybe you've heard of it. I don't know. Big one. And they did the sobriety countdown, and I was the least sober. I had the least amount of time. So I had to march up the ballroom, get the big book from the person with the most time. And it was a long, sweaty walk. And I still have my book. And unfortunately, I did have to cross out my sobriety date just one more time, which I'm about to get to. But this guy wrote in there, he wrote, Dear Stephanie, read this book and live. Love. I think it's Al. I can't remember. Is it Al or Albert? But read this book and live. That's all he wrote. So simple. And little did I know, like, how profound and how much I would was soon about to look up to people that could say things so impactfully in such few words, because that's like when I can't do it. I'm like, I always laugh with Joyce because we call it like an alley-oop. Like, I'll sit there and be like, we just did it today. I was like, so I was talking to my aunt and she just seemed like really like, I don't know. There was like no inflection when I called. It was like her voice didn't. Joyce goes, she was flat. And I was like, yes, flat. That's it. Like, I just cannot get there quickly. And I've always struggled with that. But I started to really want to achieve these more simple things. And so I really tried, started to make a beginning, you know, and the directions were hard on a mind as out of hope and angry as mine was at the time. In fact, I remember I could just feel the defiance starting to grow. I was starting to get honest. Like I said, about the truth about how I was thinking. One of them was I didn't believe I was alcoholic. And if I said that to some people, they would laugh at me and that would make me very angry because I felt I had a right to not believe I was an alcoholic. But people that knew my story just thought that was hilarious. And I still never, I'm just saying, don't laugh at someone no matter how low their bottom is if they don't believe they're alcoholic, because it's real in their mind. It was real in my mind. And one day, and so I got a boyfriend too soon, you know, people were warning me, but I was like, you know, that's like the second thing you do is just something to hide behind. And he took me to his family. And my sponsor was like, this sounds like a lot, Steph. And I was like, well, I'll be all right. We went to his family's like big 4th of July family reunion, which was like this big Irish Catholic Boston, like moon bounce tents. There was like so many people. I was brand new sober and I got there and I was in hell. This guy, because he's a real gem, just leaves me alone and goes off with his family. So now I'm in this condition alone, terrified of people. Everyone's drinking and I'm just sitting by myself, you know, and his brother who I was staying with comes over to me. He sees the condition I'm in and he's like, do you want a Valium? And do you want a Xanax? And I was like, yes. And he just gave me like 3 or 4 of them and I just ate them all, of course. And I knew it was a mistake. I knew it was a mistake. And as we were leaving there, I knew things were not going to work out with this guy. And I just knew I couldn't get honest about that. I was like, look, this has been a brutally difficult beginning. I cannot tell anyone about this because I know what they're going to do and I know what they're going to say. And I do not have it in me to start over. And this is the way I would justify things. I was like, the way I see it, it's going to be harder on me to start over. My chances are less likely than if I just live with this and do the best I can with that. Why? Because if I get honest, I'll never make it. Do you guys know what I mean? How I could do this? Okay. So that's what I thought, but I couldn't do it because I believe I had been doing the work and I couldn't live with the secret. So I just ripped the bandaid off. I called my sponsor and I said, this is what I did. I won't do it again. I am begging you on my soul. Do not make me get a 1-day chip over this. I can't do it. I won't make it. We have to find a way to just like make this go away. You know what I mean? Because I can't live through that. And she was like, I mean, I need to think about this for a night. And I was like, oh my God. Because to me, I really believed that I could be okay with that if I could get the approval of my sponsor. If she could live with it, I could live with it. We're good. And I would have too, but she couldn't live with it. She called me the next day and she said that as much as she loved me and did not want me to have to suffer, she could not go against what she believes to save me from pain. And she said, I no longer believe you have a real sobriety date. And I remember I threw my phone across the room. This is not the first time this happened with her, by the way, but this was the biggest toss, the most G-force. And in true Valerie fashion, I picked the phone up and I'm like, hello? And she's like, are you done? And I'm like, she always waited out, you know, it was unbelievable, her patience and what she could, you know, and I said, no way, I'm going to get another sponsor. And I knew I could find somebody. I didn't know what I was going to do, but then again, I couldn't do it. I wanted what she had. And I loved the way she talked to me and I could really hear her. And the way we were talking about God, I mean, that was the most important element of everything. And she was taking me around to places and I was hearing things and having surrenders and I knew were real. I had done a fourth and fifth step with her already. And there was a surrender there when she said, Stephanie, you're not a nice person. And I didn't run from that. I knew that was right. And because I didn't run and because I didn't fight it, I got to be around for the next thing she said, which was, that's not the whole story of you. Normally I could never hear that. The second you tell me something like that, you're wrong, you're out and you're erased, you know? And so those kinds of things. I remember she took me to be with her sponsor one day and I was just telling him, we were at like a bonfire and he was just telling him my sad story of like heartbreak and despair and, you know, whatever I was spinning. I mean, not spinning. I mean, it was real, but I was probably just being full of self-pity and pretty annoying. And he just looked at me and he goes, Stephanie, no one is coming to bail you out. And I was like, oh my God. I just knew that was real. And that was, for me, up until that point in my entire life, that was not a reality I could handle. Because somebody had to bail me out. If somebody's not going to bail me out, I have no shot. And, you know, and again, the conversation went, I said, well, what am I supposed to do? And he said, you have got to find a higher power that can solve your problems. And it always went to that. And so I began to seek God in a way that it was everything. I mean, I read every book anyone told me to read. I went and did anything. I mean, I would drive to the temple if there was an ashram nearby, I would have gone and lived in it. I mean, anything anybody told me to do that might help me to believe in a power greater than myself that could not just restore me to sanity, but could solve my problems, that could make something out of me, that could demonstrate something of value and worth and kindness. I mean, I was willing to do anything, and mostly to stop this pain that I was in. You know, I wanted to not wish for the end all the time. I was like wanting to know what that was like, you know, get a little taste of that, just of myself without having to have the right guy or the right money or the right stuff. And I just started doing that. And I know that there's a page in the book where it talks about, and this was a long time into my sobriety, it talks about, you know, we see a man's hope rise, you know, as we talk about he can get well despite anyone. And that was me. I was like, yes. And in my mind, I was like, no matter which one of you MFers don't like me, I can still get well, because I was still paranoid, very paranoid. But I liked that. I liked that idea. But then it's followed by that we need to believe in a God, believe in God. And then his hope would fall. And that was me, because I never thought in a million years, as good as it sounded, that I could really sink my teeth into a design for living that included, in heavy going inward and praying to God, and that was the answer, and that was the beginning. I mean, I just couldn't, like, you know, I was agnostic, as agnostic as it gets. I wasn't saying it wasn't real, that's for sure. But for me, it was definitely not going to be an option as a way of life. For sure, I was positive of it. But I still kept showing up, and I kept trying, no matter how hard it was. I remember one time my sponsor had me drive to her house in Richmond. I drove from DC to Richmond, which is like the gauntlet, because there's always at least 5 gridlock situations and bumper, you know. I drove all the way there. I had an inventory. I was ready to read it. And I got there, and, you know, I was still trying to be saved. I mean, I was always wanting somebody. I mean, you know, it's not uncommon. Like, please save me from how I feel. And if you can't, I'm mad at you, by the way. That's how I would be. And I wouldn't even, it all happened so naturally of myself that I never even realized that I was behaving that way. And she, so I got there, and she came out and sat down, and I sat down on her porch. And then she just started talking, and I was like, are we going in? And she was like, uh-uh. And I was like, I'm not coming in. She was like, no. And I was like, well, why not? And she was like, because I just have one question for you, and I want to make sure you have enough time to think about it, and your drive back home is the perfect amount of time. And I was like, geez, this is hardcore right now. And she was like, you're not living this way of life, and I just want to know if you really, really, really want what we have, because you're not doing it. And, you know, up to that point, I was still fighting with people a lot. I was, you know, I was making amends weekly on a loop, you know, using it as like a tool for get out of jail, especially in AA. And I wouldn't, she used to tell me all the time, you got to quit fighting with your pain. And I just was like, I didn't have the heart to tell her. I didn't know what that meant. And, you know, through a lot of hard work writing inventory, I started to understand that it was the way I was behaving, you know, because that we, you know, we just talked about it today, that internal fight, that dialogue that I had in there, that I just projected it out, and I created that out here with everywhere I went, and it had to stop or I was not going to be able to stay sober. So I thought about it the whole way home, and I called her, and I was like, yes, I do want to live this way. And I just started, and I just kind of like made a commitment to really try to follow directions without fighting. Like, okay, everyone was like pumped that I was showing willingness, but now the next stage of my development was to maybe stop fighting first and like just do it peacefully. So I started trying to do that. And I mean, I needed a lot of help, because I had a really bad problem with my temper and my pain. And I mean, I needed somebody to tell me how to answer the question, how are you? Somebody helped me with that. They said, Stephanie, just say that you're better than you deserve and just do a half smile. And so it doesn't seem fake. And I was like, and that was huge. It worked. And people started coming closer, and time went on, and I began to keep on seeking like I had been, and praying and reading books. And, you know, my time in the morning became, lo and behold, I went from somebody that read that page on where it says what I just said, it's like 98 or 89, but somewhere in there where it says that I had to ground my ideals in God, and I had to have trust in God. I went from feeling like that was impossible and I would never make it because of that. And also, I never thought I would really believe to my innermost self that I was alcoholic and have that kind of conviction. And I just kept going and I just kept going. And one day I just realized that I was relying on God, and I believed to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. there was no day that I remember it happened or anything. It just happened eventually. I don't even know like around how long I was sober or what, but it's just doing the work in the book. It's like, it just is like gravity. It's like, it's not going to not work if you do it, if you're honest, if you just do what it says in here, exactly what it says. You know, you don't have to be like literal. Like, I mean, you can, but I don't think like if you don't take your book down from the shelf, it's a problem, but you know, fundamentally and primarily what it says and really get honest. I mean, that's been my experience. And what my life is like now is, you know, that's those beginning years, what I was called to was not something I could have even dreamed of when I was younger. You know, initially when I got sober, I lived with my mom because I had to. I didn't have enough money to make it on my own. And I didn't, you know, I do live in the most expensive county, maybe in like the universe, but I couldn't, I didn't have a job and all that. So initially it was practical and she was helping me. And then, like I said, my dad had died back there. And my mom is from Germany. She's never received an email in her life. She to this day has never been able to handle having a cell phone. She's 93 years old. My brother and I were both adopted. My parents adopted us later in life. And it became clear that my mom couldn't really handle life without the modern world. She needed like a translator, you know what I mean? To the modern world. I was like her conduit to the modern world. And at first it was like that. And then it became more things. And my mom started to have really bad gait issues. So she was walking was hard. She had a lot of, she got COPD, you know, and eventually it just became, like, it just rolled into me needing to be there. And there was a period of time where I couldn't handle that. I was so angry at God that not only, this is how I felt, not only did you not give me a husband or children in the appropriate timeline to which I could pull that off, which I always wanted, you know, I thought, but now you've got me, and I love my mom. It was never a question of that, but this seemed, you know, and that brother that I had that fight with, we'd made our amends. I'd made my amends to him and his wife. And then he got sober and then he got unsober. And a lot has happened, you know, both good and bad. But for me, I've been called to something that is extremely challenging. No doubt about it. Anyone that knows me and is in close proximity to my life will say it's challenging. But it has got to be one of the most incredible, beautiful, jaw-droppingly cool journeys you could ask for. Now, do I still sometimes struggle out in the world when I'm talking to my peers about where I live and what I do and their judgment? Yeah, 100% I do. It's not something that I readily can feel proud of like I could if I was like, oh yeah, my daughter's got a blue ribbon in the swim meet. You know what I mean? I'm like, my mom's still doing her own meds, guys, and she's driving. I mean, no one really cares. But to me, I do have that kind of pride. I do. You know, even tonight before Joyce got here, these kind of things happen all the time. And Joyce knows I couldn't do this without her, seriously. Like, she has taken days off work to take my mom to doctor's appointments and stuff like that. But I always look at her bills before I put them in the mailbox, because every once in a while, something will get, you know, and she had her property tax, but she just took the whole thing, the whole bill, and put a stamp on it and her return address. And at first I was like, you know, you're sending this to yourself. And she was like, yeah, and she's super German, but she was able to tell me everything. Like, oh, it's my property. She's 90, almost 92. Oh, it's my property tax. It's going to be in two installments. It's $2,310. I do it every year. And I open it up and it was exactly. And I'm like, so proud of her. Like, but there's really no peer group for that. But that's how I felt, you know. So I mean, slowly but surely, I have been blessed beyond measure in ways that are not the ones I would have picked. But I'm not in charge. So I'm really grateful to be here. I'm definitely grateful to be sober. And I want to thank you for everything. Thanks, guys.
Beautiful talk. Beautiful talk.
Wow, Stephanie, thanks for